Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host. It's been raining quite heavily here in Northern California. We've had torrential rains here. Flooded in Marin County, flooded San Francisco, flooded parts of the East Bay where I'm at here in Oakland. But we need the rain, so I'm happy. We're continuing to have rain. I hope the weather's good where you're living and where you're listening. Welcome to the program. Earth Ancients is a funny development. I started this radio show earlier this year, and we're getting close to our first 8 months. I should say actually 9 months of being around, and each program is more enlightening than the next. Our last guest, Michael Tellinger, his work is just phenomenal. And his book on the Anunnaki, his research on electromagnetics, and his study into these ruins, which he estimates to be in the millions in South Africa, continues to fascinate not only me, but a number of other researchers. I've had more calls, more people emailing me about Tellinger's work than any other speaker that or presenter that we've had in the last several months. And I'm really happy to have him on the program, but I didn't realize that he had such a large body of work. And if you go to the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook, I posted a series of photographs following the interview. And what I didn't understand is the photographs that he has posted, each of those stone ruins, including the massive walls, they're all energized in some way. They're all emitting electromagnetic energy. And Michael sent me an email following our conversation, and wants to tell everyone to please go to his website check out some more photographs that he's recently published on that site. So I did list it on the page, but he's also got a small tour. It's the Tellinger Museum tour of vanished civilizations and sound energy, which I published or I posted about 3 or 4 days ago. So if you're interested in learning about last week's guest, Michael Tellinger, jump on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients, and have a listen. He is continuing to be quite a fascinating guest. And I'm probably going to have him over on the program again, because he has a new book coming out that just talks about this technology that we do not have any means to detect other than electromagnetic magnetometers that can test magnetic fields. He predicts that one day somebody's going to come up with iPhone app that can scan or pick up sound frequencies and translate them. He even gives the example of having some kid walk into one of these buildings in South Africa and tap his phone or maybe even a tablet with some kind of a software application built into it and be able to decode what these messages are. What's fascinating about that is I've always believed that the ancient Egyptians and the Maya and some of the ancient people of South America imbued their buildings with sound frequencies that are encoded with information. I've experienced everything from headaches to altered states of consciousness when I've climbed a number of pyramids in the Yucatan and in Central America. And my guess now, and I haven't been down to Yucatan in a few years, but my guess is that they're just radiating these energies. Because remember, now we know that the ancient Maya built a number of their pyramids on top of electromagnetic fields. John Burke reminds us that those are telluric fields that have a natural electromagnetic fields that pulse up, and then the Maya were able to channel that into their buildings and then somehow use that energy to probably at one time to power devices, probably machines, as crazy as that sounds, and other devices. So anyhow, that it's a fascinating consideration, and Tellinger is really at the forefront. A couple other areas I want to mention. There's a new flyover video that I posted of the Indonesian ruin, Gunung Padang, the pyramid. And the drone that flies over takes one of the best, if not the best, photographs excuse me, of the of that pyramid. And as we know, they've dug down and found a number of chambers and have dated the one of the fifth or the older chambers to be 20,000 years or older. And quite a few researchers, authors are there investigating it. In fact, Graham Hancock has made quite a bit of noise about it because it is pushing our understanding of ancient history quite deep into the past. Remember, I did post some information about a diode or a piece of metal that looked like a some kind of a transformer or something that ran electricity through it. We haven't seen a picture of that, but if I ever do get a photograph, I'll post it immediately, which would be a fantastic find. They're finding a lot of metal in that pyramid. If you go to the Facebook page, look at, let's see, November 30th. Actually, it was posted December 1st, the flyover at Gunung Padang Pyramid in Indonesia. And it gives you a good idea of just how big the structure is. It's a monstrous structure, 300 or 400 feet in the air when it's measured. I also want to bring to the attention of everyone listening the latest findings underneath Rome. And we've known for years that the Spanish covered over most of the Aztec ruins when they conquered the Aztecs. And archaeologists are continually finding pyramids, buildings, complete complexes covered up by the Spanish. But this is an interesting new discovery. In Rome, they have discovered complete foundations, streets, and the ruins of a much earlier period of Rome. Some of the ruins actually predate ancient Rome, which is 300 BC. So it seems like even the Romans have an ancient history that we don't know about. And it's a fascinating find. The title, which was published a few days ago, it's called Interesting Discoveries of from Ancient Rome. And there's a picture that I got from Associated Press of one of these massive foundations that was carved and laid. And it looks like, I think it's actually an early kind of a cement. So take a look at that. As always, I suggest everyone peruse the Earth Ancients Facebook page, constantly placing information there. And then there's an Earth Ancients podcast. It's not really a podcast. It's a blog that I post. If you just go to Earth Ancient Groups, it's more of a personal reflection that I post, and there's a lot of authors' information on there. So I invite you to take a look at that. So my guest today, we're bringing her back, is Dr. Artie Sixkiller-Clark. Dr. Clark, I had on the program earlier in the year, and her book was on Sky People from the United States, the Native Americans in the United States. This new book we hinted about a little bit, which is The Sky People of Mesoamerica, Encounters with Star People. And this book is dynamite. And my guest today, Dr. Artie Sixkiller-Clark, brings to the field of ufology degrees in history, English, psychology, educational leadership, and a background as a teacher, university professor, licensed therapist, psychologist, and social researcher. She's a professor emeritus at Montana State University, director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education, and her work is primarily with indigenous people. She's the perfect candidate to interview Native people. She has an understanding of that. Her first bestseller was Encounters with Star People, and that, as I mentioned, was within the United States. Now, this new book, where she actually goes to Central America and interviews the Mayan culture, is a fascination to me because she basically retraces the footsteps of early explorers, two who are well known, John Stevens and Frederick Catherwood. And if you don't remember those two explorers, they wrote a book called Incidents of Travel in Central America, Chiapas, and Yucatan. And then they follow that up with a book called Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan. And for me, those were my first kind of introduction into ruins left by the ancient Maya. And I'm going to bring Artie out now. Hi, Artie. Are you there?
I'm here. It's good
to
hear
from welcome
you.
To the program. Yes, yes. By the way, congratulations on your new book. It's officially available on Amazon. Is that correct?
That's right.
Fantastic.
I think it's still a pre-order on Amazon. I'm not sure. I know that they were saying that probably December 15th, somewhere between the 15th and 22nd, it would be available. But I haven't checked the site recently, so.
Okay. Well, I have had a chance to look at an edited copy sent by your publisher, new book. Is it New World Book? What's the publisher?
New Page,
yes. And I just can't say enough about it. Now, you drove, according to this here, you drove more than 12,000 miles. You visited 89 archaeological sites. And conducted nearly 100 individual interviews. Now, how many years did it take you to do this?
About 10 years.
Oh, my God.
Yes, and I would spend anywhere from about 12 days to 2 months. at a time when I was there. I really immersed myself into the Maya culture and to the, you know, the little villages and getting to know the people. But I think that's one of the reasons why I was able to get such honest stories and to uncover information that other people had not paid attention to.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there something about the Mayan culture that was of great interest to you? I mean, obviously, Stevens and Catherwood were the impetus for you to go down there, but was there something specific about the Mayan culture that was fascinating to you?
Well, I was very interested in their astronomy, that they had such great knowledge of the universe. I was also, I had read von Daniken's books, and I just, you know, was having difficulty wholeheartedly embracing, you know, his ancient astronaut theories. And so, and I just decided that, although I had always promised myself that one day I was going to follow in the footsteps of Stevens and Catherwood, when I was in high school, I first read their books. And so I said, I'm going to do this. And then along as the years passed, my interest grew in more directions. And so I decided, since I had been collecting stories from indigenous people about their encounters, that I would do the same thing in Central America and Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did.
Yes, and your books filled with great, great stories. Now, obviously, Stevens and Catherwood were in Central America at a time where there were no paved roads. So
right.
when you say you followed his path, their path, it was more of kind of a following their path maybe with paved roads now, and then maybe
right.
going off the paved roads when you went to see a ruin. But did you actually follow their paved roads from when they landed in Belize, or how does it start for you?
Well, you know, their first stopover was Belize. At that time, it was mm-hmm. British Honduras, and
right.
there was basically, you know, a kind of a civil war going on in British Honduras at the time, and mm-hmm. They just used Belize as a stopover, and they rested, and then they started their trek into. They stopped in Belize City, not the country. They were in British Honduras, so they spent a couple of days in Belize City, and then they went on to Copan, in British Honduras. That was the first actual ancient city that they visited.
Right.
And
in your studies, I mean, you are a scientist in many ways, and you do quantitative and qualitative research. So you were very careful in how you you did your interviews. But overall, would you say that the Maya had a regular connection with star people over thousands of years, or would you say that it's more of a recent phenomenon?
Oh, it's existed ever since they built their cities on this planet. You know, they it's not a recent phenomenon at all. And
Okay. So, would you say that the shaman and the priests that are present day are the holders of whatever knowledge is left? Because we know that the Spanish literally burnt libraries of their ancient knowledge. What do you feel is who bears that information now among the Maya?
Well, I think they're village priests. Many of them still have that knowledge, and I met with priests who told me they still travel the universe. not physically as you and I might think, but that, you know, they say that their language is the language of, you know, of the stars, that their people still live in the universe on other planets, and that they can travel through time and still go to those places. And they have a chant that they use, you know, that they call up the gods and still speak with the ancients.
Okay, and I mean, has your research changed your opinion of the Maya? I mean, these are very, very unique. Well, I mean, I'm very impressed with the Maya. I mean, I've been to the ruins countless times and believe that there's an untold story that, for me, it's that the Maya are much older than historians provide them or give them. But what in the end, and we're going to get into some chapters here in a minute, but I just want to get an overview, what your overview is of the Maya that you've encountered and what your opinion is of them now as a culture.
Well, I have tremendous respect for the Maya. The most significant thing I think that I feel about the Maya is that in all the research that I've done among indigenous people, they are the only group of indigenous people who came to Earth that brought their knowledge with them. They did not have someone else on Earth bring their knowledge to them. They came here with their knowledge, and they used their knowledge to build the cities. One elder told me, and I think it sums up, you know, everything about the Maya. He said, we were not impressed with the Spanish culture. To us, they were not technologically advanced because we came from a society that was much more advanced than they. And so, you know, when that to me was, you know, just an amazing statement. They did not go greet the Spaniards as gods like the Aztecs did, because they knew what an advanced culture was. And
right.
Spanish was not an advanced culture, and they were not gods. They were predators to the Maya.
So is it your opinion that the ancient Maya were not from the Earth, that they actually came from the stars?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I believe that.
And
many of them tell me that.
Okay. So if you were to give an educated guess at how old the Maya truly are, would you say they're much significantly older than the 3,000 years that we give them? So they're
absolutely
prehistoric.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So greater than 10,000 years, maybe.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I think they've been finding some ancient relics just in the past year that validate that are more than 10,000 years old. You know,
well, we know. We do know. There's a doctor in Chiapas at El Mirador who has redated a number of the ruins, and he dates them as contemporaries of the Olmec, which makes them extremely old. But he believes they're significantly older than that. But he won't say that publicly because he'll lose his funding.
I know. Well, this is one of the crazy things about the field of archaeology. Although I do have to say that I think the archaeologists are paying a lot more attention to these ancient stories of indigenous people than what they once did.
I think so. For once, finally, I mean, the myths are becoming truths. Then that's a question for you, and then we're going to jump into some of these chapters. What's your feeling of native myths? Because the academic world considers myths as fables, falsehoods, whereas the native people have a lot of oral traditions and some of them are myths. And shouldn't we be more considerate about those myths?
Well, I certainly think so. I think that you find as man progressed from, you know, the Stone Age into the Industrial Age, suddenly, you know, the intellectual thought moved from oral history was frowned upon and criticized and disregarded as nothing but a myth. And all of a sudden, everything was objective, that the oral word could not be counted on. And that's a great tragedy, in my opinion, because the ancient stories, while they may have been changed somewhat for the entertainment of children, these were not children's stories. The real meat of the stories, I think, you know, had truth in them and were based mm-hmm. on truth. And so, you know, I don't disregard them. And perhaps that's the reason why I have access to some of the information that other researchers haven't been able to have. Because when you go into a village and you've heard this ancient story that this man came down on a beam of light and he stood on this rock, and when he spoke, his voice sounded like thunder. Mm-hmm. And then he lived among the people, and he took a woman in the village for a wife. You know, and they had a son, and that son, when he became an adult, married, and the father went back and stood on that rock, and a beam came down and took him back to the sky. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's just nonsense. That's just a story to entertain children. I don't believe that. I think that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the artifacts in that at that particular place, you'll see that, you know, the depiction of that leader, he's wearing goggles. I mean, there's just a lot to indicate that their image of him was someone who probably came from the stars. And the story says he did. You know, so why? Who are we to say this is just a children's story? It's just a myth made up to entertain. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm. In your first book, there are references to myths in various American tribes, but the myths are handed down in a similar fashion that they are with American or the U.S. Native groups. But what I think is quite interesting, and you've already touched on it, is that they are cherished, you know, there's certain individuals that in the old times were selected to carry these memories and to speak about them in certain ceremonies. Did you find a number of daykeepers in Mesoamerica that you spoke with, or was there just a couple that are in your book, the priests?
What I found is that you could go into villages where nobody had any knowledge of the ancient stories. You know, if you're traveling in that part of the country, you know, or part of the world, it's the small villages are just so isolated and so far removed from civilization, so to speak, that many of them don't have any knowledge, and yet you'll go into another isolated village where there is somebody who has kept that ancient knowledge alive. One explanation I was given for that was that, you know, any time a culture faces a calamity, such as what happened to the Maya, you are in the mode of survival. you aren't interested in maintaining all the ancient knowledge. All you want to do is take your family, get into the jungle, and survive. Mm-hmm. And so that a lot of that knowledge was lost, and yet there were other circumstances where it wasn't lost. And and I think that's probably what one elder told me. He said, you know, just imagine that if a calamity would happen to America, and 10,000 years from now, somebody is traveling America, and they come upon the Statue of Liberty. They would probably call her the Goddess of Fire. That's what the people would refer to her. He said the same thing happened to us. You know, and a lot of that knowledge was given up in terms of just surviving, was lost in terms of surviving. And, I believe that's exactly what happened to the Maya. The Maya never really warred that much with the Spanish, because they just went into the jungle and escaped. There are some accounts the Spanish taking over battling with some of the in Guatemala, but when the Spanish came in, the Maya just moved away, and of course, you know, most of the great many of the Catholic churches that were built in Mexico were built using the stones of these ancient cities, which the Spaniards just went in and tore down, you know, and then they built their churches on top of them.
I've seen many Mayan a church built on top of Mayan ruins, and you're right.
That's exactly right.
And up and down.
And you walk through small towns, and here are bricks from these ancient cities used to build storefronts, and they were just looted, and so there were a lot of those great cities that were destroyed in that manner, you know, and the Maya, when, you know, what happened, you know, when the bishop Landa, you know, he burned all of their codices and all of their religious artifacts, which he considered worship of idols, and he destroyed everything. And I remember my guide saying that his family had always told stories of the crying and the wailing of the people when all of this was going on. And it was just a very sad time for the Maya. And they basically just disappeared into the jungles. And that's where they are today, you know.
Yeah.
Except for the ones that you see in tourist areas, you know, that are serving the people. And most of them, many of them are not full-blood Maya. And, you know, there's a very strong class system in that part of the world. You know, the Maya are at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you have the mixed, and then you have the Spanish, you know, and the Maya already refer to them as the Mexicans. Those Mexicans, they don't call themselves the Mexicans. They are not Mexicans. They are whatever, you know, group they are from. That's who they are.
Yeah.
They make that distinction. And I was surprised that pervades even throughout the Yucatan. And I remember asking this one man, he said, you know, we better get out of here because these Mexicans, look at them, they're just coming in droves, he said. And that was the first time I'd heard that, and I said, well, you're Mexican. He said, oh, no, I'm not. I'm Yucatecan.
Yeah.
I'm not Mexican, you know. And of course, the Yucatan, you know, and that caste war that was fought, you know, between the Mexican government and the Maya people.
Yes.
You know, was, you know, just points out that attitude is still there, although the Maya quit fighting. They just retreated back to their villages. You know, and I visited villages in Mexico where Mexican law did not exist. They had their own law. And there was nothing, if somebody got in trouble in those villages, there was nothing any government could do to help you out. And one of the other interesting things I found is the continuation of religious practices. I participated in religious ceremonies that were the same kind of ceremony that was held during the early days of the Maya, and I participated in religious ceremonies that was a combination of Christianity and the Maya religion. I was in one village where Jesus Christ is considered a disciple, and John the Baptist was worshipped as a prophet. You know, there's just a lot of different things that go on in these small villages that a tourist necessarily wouldn't encounter. If you're just driving through and you're looking looking for the cities, and most of them where they'll go to Chichen Itza, they'll go to Uxmal, and they'll go to Palenque. I tried to search out those that. When I went to those places, I mean, like you, I love Palenque. It's one of the most spiritual places, I believe, in the world.
Yes.
And Chichen Itza, you know, has turned into a tourist center.
It has, unfortunately. Let's talk a little bit about the book, because your book is wonderful, Artie. I'll go through some of the areas that I thought chapters I thought were outstanding, and you can tell us a little bit about it. So, chapter 2, A Double on Another Planet. Now, this is a fascinating story because it actually describes an individual who has been cloned.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Long before we ever knew about cloning, I might add.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, I was in Belize, and I had a driver who was he identified himself as a Red Carib Indian, and the Red Caribs, as he told me, never married with the African slaves who escaped when those slave traders were coming through. There were the Red Carib and the Yellow Carib, and they never mixed. But the Garifuna, they are a mixture of black and Indian. And so my driver told me that he had a cousin who had told him that he had been taken when he was just an infant, or not an infant, but a toddler, and that he had repeatedly had encounters with people from the stars. And so one day he drove me to meet him, and well, we went to look for him because he hadn't seen his cousin for several decades, I think about 30 years, he said. And we found him, and he was willing to tell me his story, and he said that he was about 4 years old when he first encountered them, and at first he thought they were children, that, you know, he played with them, and he thought they were a lot of fun. And but that you know, as he grew older, when he was about 9 or 10, he said, you know, he realized that there was something much more, much different about them. And he said they started coming several times a year, and they would take him on board their spaceship. And he said one of the things that they did, a lot of tests, like they would do things where they would give him problems, like some kind of manipulatives, and they wanted to see how he would solve a problem, and mm-hmm. they would observe him and watch him. And at the same time, they were taking his knowledge all the knowledge that he possessed, and he told me about they were taking his knowledge and they were cloning him. He said that when he was 16, his clone actually went back to Earth and he stayed on the spaceship. And he said he stayed there for 2 weeks in his village impersonating him, and no one knew the difference.
What part of Mexico was that located in, Ari? What part of Mexico?
That wasn't in Mexico. This was in Belize.
Oh, that was in Belize. Okay.
It was in Belize. And he said he was told they were populating another planet. Mm. And that his clone would go to this other planet. He would be one of the people, and that they needed his skills on this other planet. And that's the reason why they had cloned him. They wanted his clone to have all the knowledge of farming and plants and all the things that he knew. And so, and he said, but he never regarded it. When he said, you know, he rebelled a little bit when he was in his teenage years because he wanted to be doing other things with his friends. But he said that he came to respect them so much, and he said probably they were the reason why I went to college, because they gave me so much knowledge. And he said that because I knew there was more than just the village I lived in. He said, I decided that I wanted to know more. And he said, so I regard them as the impetus that made me go to college. And he said that the night he graduated from college, they came to see him. And they told him they were finished with him. And they told him that his double had learned what he needed to know. And that he would be a farmer like him on another planet.
That's amazing.
And that they were populating another planet, and he says he's never seen them again.
You know, as a researcher, as a Orthodox educated person, how do you take a story like that? I mean, do you just say, well, you know, it seems like he's telling the truth, he's sincere enough, I will accept that for my book? Or, I mean, how do you approach that? I mean, you've been interviewing Native people for years now, and when someone tells you a story like that, how do you react to that?
Well, I try not to react, because I think that's, you know, I try not to say, well, you know, I don't believe this, you know, or I think this is a lie. You know, just dismiss it. Because I think that's what's happened so much to people who tell their stories, that we put our own opinions and inferences into their stories. My process is to simply go into these communities to have trusted people, people they trust. If I don't know them, if I haven't been seen in the village for a while, if people don't know who I am, to have somebody that they trust to know that I'm trustworthy, because that's really important in the indigenous community, is that in any indigenous community I've been in, is that they either know they can trust you from your reputation, or you are accompanied by somebody that they believe, that they trust, that they believe it's okay to tell you their story. And I don't question them in the sense of a scientist. I'm a social scientist, so I'm interested in stories. I'm interested in hearing theirs. They have no reason to lie to me. He wasn't right. given some kind of information that, you know, tell this woman a story. You know, he was just sat down and it was a conversation about his experience. I don't have any questions that this didn't happen to him.
And
it wasn't
and
a dream.
And the stories are so detailed in the book that the imaginations to come up with that would have to be pretty wild.
That's right.
You know? Yeah.
And, you know, I heard repeatedly when I was in traveling that there were other planets that had been populated by these sky people. Mm-hmm. I heard that from a lot more than just this man. You know, that that the sky people have enough knowledge and power that they can take a planet, they can terraform it, they can make it the climate compatible with theirs. They mm-hmm. can do all sorts of things to make a planet inhabitable. Mm-hmm. And but they're very specific that there's only one or two groups of sky people who can do that.
Wow. You have a fantastic section of your book. Actually, it kind of runs throughout your book, and it's an area that I have had a problem with just because there's a whole series of programs called Ancient Aliens. And the reason I have a problem with it is that anything that they cannot explain in these programs, they attribute to ancient aliens.
I know.
And so in my website and in my Facebook page and on this program, I don't really endorse ancient alien research because it's for most of it, it's just like hearsay. It's hearsay. But in your case,
speculation, you know, I mean, it's taking something and it's speculating that this is what happened. And I asked the Maya about that. I asked them repeatedly, what do you think of these ancient astronaut theories, or what do you think about the idea that somebody came from the sky and built your ancient cities? And and they say, I said, did anybody ever ask you? Well, in fact, one man said to me, Von Daniken got it all wrong, he said. He said, and I said, why do you say that? Well, he said, because he never asked us.
Interesting.
He never asked us. He just speculated about how these cities were built. He said, we built these cities, or our ancestors built these cities. He said, the aliens he talks about are us. We came here. We built these cities, and we stayed.
Fascinating.
And I heard that several times, that they came from another world and that they built the cities, and they are the descendants of the people who came from the stars.
That's amazing. Let's talk about a couple of these chapters. You have a fascinating chapter. It's called The Silver Men from the Stars, where I believe it's I can't remember what part of Central America, but
it was in Honduras.
Oh, it was in Honduras, and this group of natives went into a cave, and they actually found the remains of a being in a silver suit. Tell us a little bit about that. That's fascinating.
Well, I was outside of Copan. There's Copan extends over a large area, and there was an area of the ancient site that where the what archaeologists say is where the people actually lived. Mm-hmm. And I ran onto this old man, and he said to me, you know, he told me he was born in 1904. That he was 5 years old when Herbert Spinden, who was a curator of anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, when he came to Copan, and he said he kept hanging around, And finally, he said he actually had worked at the site of Copan for 75 years. And he said that Spindon was the first to hire him. And he said, at that time, I was young, but he said, I was strong. And he said, mostly I was his runner. I would run and get him things. I would carry water to them. I brought their lunches to the site. And he was telling me how he worked for 10 cents a day. And Spindon had told him if he'd learn English, he would increase his pay to 25 cents a day. And so he said about learning English. But he said that one of the ways that they got extra money is that he and his friends would go into the mountains where they knew there were all this ancient stuff, and they would go into the mountains and they would look for this stuff and they would bring them back, and these archaeologists would give them money for these artifacts. And they went in to the mountains and found this remains of a skeleton in a cave that was dressed in a silver suit. Mm. And they brought it back to the archaeologist. And he said that the suit was silver from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And he said that inside the suit was obviously a skeleton. And he said the person who had once been inside this suit was a small man. He said he was smaller than me. And Luis probably was maybe close to 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. So he said his head, he said, was covered with a hard metal-like tube. And that they found a tablet with strange characters on it lying beside him. And he said it was not the Maya writing on the temple that he had seen on the temples. So they carried this back to the archaeologists, and the archaeologists were very excited. They took this a skeleton into one of the tents and started examining it. And he said he heard one of them say, "We've got to send this back to the university or the USA immediately." And he said, you know, now that he reflects on it, he knows it was proof that the Maya had a connection with the stars. Mm-hmm. But he said the next day he saw a box in the tent, and he knew they were packing him up to ship him to their university, and he said, "I never saw it again." And he said, "I'm sure that the scientist in the USA has studied and restudied him, but they keep it a secret." And he was haunted by this because he said, "You know, I did something that was probably very bad, but I was a child." He said, "They only gave me $2. But in those days, we thought we were rich, you know." But he said, "If I had not revealed that, it would have been definite proof that we had that connection with the stars."
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating story. And
it is a fascinating story.
Of course, there's huge speculation now that the American institutions, we now know that the National Geographic has been doing some underhanded things in ancient Egypt. The Smithsonian is suspected at covering up a number of archaeological finds, not only in America, but in other parts of North America. And so when I hear that kind of story, it saddens me because it's knowledge that we don't have.
Now, I've been told this, that in Mexico, the second biggest crime in Mexico is the illegal trading, outside of drugs, is the illegal trading in ancient artifacts.
Yes. Mm.
And so people are, and I saw evidence of that. You would go, you know, some of the places that Stevens and Catherwood went to, you know, I had to go and knock on doors and ask people if they would allow me on their land in order to go see the places that Stevens and Catherwood had seen, because they weren't on a paved road. They weren't a part of the tour group, you know, that goes to these ancient sites.
Right.
But I wanted to make that trip as much as possible and see what Stevens and Catherwood had seen. That was my initial goal when I was 16 years old, that I wanted to do this. And what you would find when you would go, you know, to some of these places that were out of the way, you would actually find where people had been digging. And they were digging for artifacts that they could sell on the black market. But they say that is the second biggest crime, is the selling of artifacts.
I regularly post artifacts that are listed on eBay. I used to do it every couple of weeks. I used to post some of the amazing artifacts that are up for auction. And it saddens me, but it also shows just how sophisticated a lot of the native people are in Central America, because some of the artifacts actually have individuals wearing very sophisticated clothing and wearing and holding devices that we have no idea what they are. So there's but because it's such a poor area in most of the parts of that southern Mexico, in Chiapas and even Belize, that it's a way for people to make a living, I guess. It's kind of sad.
Well, in Guatemala, I mean, I've never seen such poverty as what you see in Guatemala among the indigenous people there. I mean, it's really sad, you know. And so if you can get a few bucks and it'll feed your family for a week or a month, you know, you're going to do it.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, that's just all there is to it.
Let's talk about, I think we both, before the show, were talking a little bit about Palenque. You have a couple of wonderful chapters on Palenque. Palenque is a special place. I've been there myself. It's a sacred place. But you interviewed a couple of people who not only witnessed alien beings, but also described the connection with the ruler there, Pikal. Tell us a little bit about the chapter that you wrote on Palenque and why it's such a special place.
Well, Palenque, the story is that when Palenque was built originally, it was supposed to be the place to store the knowledge of the universe. And they say that what happened to Palenque, what people tell you happened to Palenque, that it never became that storehouse of all the knowledge, is that after it was built, the builders refused to leave. And they inhabited the city, and so therefore the knowledge was never left. There are many stories about travelers that came from the stars and visited Palenque, and stories that a tower was built there, and it was a place that allowed leaders to travel back and forth between this planet and Earth, that they would enter the tower and it would be transported to the stars. When Stevens and Catherwood arrived in Palenque, it was, it was an overgrown city filled with mosquitoes, and it's in the jungle. I mean, it sits on the side of a mountain in the jungle, and so it was a miserable experience for them, even though they did stay, I think it was 28 days, and promised to return, but they never got back there. Today, you know, when you go to Palenque, it's like a sideshow. You know, people are out there walking everything under the sun, you know, and the heat is quite oppressive, because it is up there in the jungle, in that, you know, in the Tumbala Mountains, but that high canopy jungle is just absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, and extremely humid. Yeah.
And King Pikal, he ruled the city for 68 years. He was responsible for a lot of the great, well, Palenque has 500 buildings that have been identified, but that's only, say there's more than 80% of the city that remains uncovered in the rainforest. So, you know, it's a magnificent place. When you think of 500 buildings have been identified, but that's only 20% of what the city is. The rest of it has never been uncovered. And so it's an amazing place to visit. The Maya themselves, they do not really, you know, in the old days, the priests would tell them to stay out of the city because, when the Catholics got into, they told them, you know, you stay out of the city, that city is evil. And so they told me that the spirits of the old ones come to Palenque. And mm-hmm. so the superstitious Maya, and I think you'll see that throughout the book as you read, you know, how superstition permeates a lot of present-day life. And that they wouldn't spend a night there, but this one night security guard, they said he was not Maya, he was Mexican, and he ignored the warnings about the spirits. And so he was in the city at night, and he saw the people come from the stars and enter the Pyramid of Inscriptions and disappear.
Wow.
And when he described them, he told them they were tall and white. They glowed. They were white. They were spirits, he said. And they entered the, came on a spacecraft that was round. He said it looked like a hat, a flat hat. It smelled awful, he said, like hell smells, he said. And he tasted metal, and it made him sick, and his head hurt. And he said that after that, he left. He never wanted anything to do with Palenque again. So that was one of the stories I heard that I thought was quite amazing. One of the things that's really interesting is, you know, this is a city that King's Cow is what Von Daniken has put in his books, that he was the ancient astronaut, that he wasn't a Maya, he was an ancient astronaut that came and built the mm-hmm. city. And he's got this whole thing, you know, this depiction of Pacal going into the underworld, a carving. He said it was a spacecraft. And it's the tree of life, you know, and he's sitting in this position where he's going into the underworld, which is what the Maya believe, you know, that you
right.
make this transition. And what's interesting to me is how the vendors outside of Palenque have embraced that concept and will stop you and say, have you heard about our astronaut Pacal? You know, because they're trying to make a sale. They're trying to...
Yeah.
And a lot of tourists from Europe really, you know, just grasp that idea that this was a man from the stars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which he wasn't at all. You know, there's no truth in that or no fact in that at all. But it is an interesting place.
Yeah. So what do the locals tell you about Pacal? Because he was a bearer of certain knowledge, and the Maya seem to have a very curious understanding of the cosmos and astronomy. And the few codices or scientific books that are left to us have extremely accurate descriptions of the revolution of Venus and Mars and the moon. And it's almost like they have technical data. It's not that technical, but it's like one author, James O'Conn, in one of the early interviews I gave, and he's an engineer who's written quite a bit about the Maya engineering, he believes that the codices were translated from technical manuals that the Maya had accumulated over the thousands of years that they'd been on the planet. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, I can't question his theory, because I really don't know what was on those codices, and it could very well have been that. When you consider the fact that when Palenque was built, and from all I could gather from the elders, is it was intended to be the storehouse of knowledge. Mm-hmm. When I talked to the Hopi in the Southwest, their ancient stories tell them that there is a city to the south of them, a red city, that holds all the knowledge, the great knowledge of the universe. Now, Palenque was once painted red.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, and you'll see that, you know, if you stop and take a close look at the you'll still see remnants of the red paint at Palenque. But, you know, over the thousands of years that it stood there, you know, it's disappeared. But you'll see red paint throughout. They like to paint their houses, their cities red. And in Copan, in some of those places, they even use mica mixed in so that the cities glittered in the sun. And you can imagine living at that time, coming in and seeing this golden red city glittering in the sun, you know, out in the middle of the jungle. Wouldn't that have been amazing?
Would have been fantastic.
I know. I mean, I just can't imagine that. But that's exactly what they did. You know, their cities were their art, and the majority of them have what we call observatories.
Yes.
And they watched the stars, and they knew about the stars, it's an amazing culture.
Yeah. I want to finish up with a fun little chapter that you have when you were in Copan, and some of the natives told you about communing with the ancient ones or the old ones. And one night you went out and you actually witnessed some pretty fascinating stuff. You want to tell us about that chapter when you were taken out for an evening view of some old ones?
I was staying in this hotel, and of course, the city is called Copan Ruinous. I don't know why, because you would think that would be the name of the ancient site. The ancient site is actually called Copan, but the modern day town around Copan has about 10,000 people in it, and it's a place where everybody knows everybody. There are no street signs. There's no names of places, but all you have to do is give a name, and people can give you directions. I was in my hotel room, and this lady who was cleaning my room asked me if I was indigenous, and I said yes, I'm from the USA. And she said that if you go into the ruins at night, you might see the old ones, she said. And she said, but our priest says that you have to be indigenous in order for them to show up. And so I began talking to her, and when I asked her who the old ones were, she said they were the gods. And she says they come in many forms. She says sometimes they come from the sky, sometimes they come from the jungle, sometimes they come as light, she said. She said that I'm only telling you this because our priest told us that you would come. And he said that after you come, there will be richness. And I was really taken back by what she was saying, because she said, The priest says that you're here for a good purpose, and that we must share with you the secrets of the old ones. And she said, this is the first time that anyone from the outside has been chosen to learn our secrets. And I said, you know, who are you talking about? The Catholic priest? Because that's the only priest I knew that was. And she said, oh, no, I come from a village in the mountains, she said. And she says that our priest said that somebody would come from El Norte, and it would be a woman. And that woman, after she comes here, she will love the people so much that the gods will make the tourists come. And keep in mind, this was at a period when it was around 2008 when the economy had kind of crashed and tourists weren't traveling that much and mm-hmm. people weren't on planes and stuff, and so their economy had really suffered, and the people there, you know, that's what they depend on other than their crops. And so she said that everyone in our village believes that you're that woman, she says. And I'm just really, I don't know what to do. And I said, and my boss says, and she talked about this, well, I guess the manager, owner of the hotel, she says, you know, he says you're a famous person. And I said, I'm not a famous person. I'm just a teacher. I'm a professor. And she says, well, you know, if you want to see the old one, she says, tonight at midnight, my brother will come for you, and he will lead you into the ancient city. Well, I knew that was against the law, but she says, no, you are the woman.
Artie, are you there?
Wow, can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. Okay, we lost you for a minute, but go ahead.
Oh,
yeah.
But she said, if you're the woman the gods say you are, then, or the priest says you are, then you will see the ancients. And so at midnight, Teodoro showed up, knocked on my door, and I followed him into the jungle. When we got in to the site, climbed one of the pyramids, and he said, now we wait. And we sat there, you know, watching the stars and the bats and everything else that was playing, you know, around, flying, and almost at dawn, these lights appeared in below us. They flitted around like they were balls of light that just, like they were playing, like they were having fun. All of a sudden, one came. I'm sitting there just transfixed by this scene, and one of them comes, and right up in front of me, and just doesn't move. It breaks off from all the others, and it just comes in front of me. And then all the other lights floated into a formation behind him. They hovered there, and then all of a sudden they just disappeared on the night air. And Teodoro looks at me and says, you are one of us. And, you know, I was just speechless, thinking, what had I seen? And while I'm trying to make sense of all this, sunlight starts to flood the plaza, and I see a large circular rotating wheel-like craft appear overhead. Now this thing looks like a wheel, and I watched, you know, just basically speechless at this revolving wheel that disappeared toward the east, and the sun had come up, and I was squinting my eyes and looking in the direction of the sun, but the craft was gone. And then I was scheduled to leave that morning, you know, to go to...
Oh, return to the States?
No, to continue my trip.
Oh.
And a new driver was coming to pick me up to take me into Guatemala. And because Teodora said, we'll go back tonight, at midnight. And I said, but I can't. He said, it's been a long time, he said, since we've seen the old ones. But our priest said you had the power to bring them back to me, to us. And he says, I kept saying, I have no power. I'm a university professor. And he said, the priest said your visit would restore balance, that a woman would come who is unselfish and kind and good. And he says, I kept saying, I'm not sure I'm the one that your priest prophesied. And he said, oh, see, you are the one. And when I left there, I promised to go back.
Wow.
And see them again. I haven't been back, but it's on my bucket list.
I'll tell you, that's pretty amazing to see an actual ship.
A typical kind of ship.
Yeah.
It wasn't a ship like the round disc or the cigar-shaped, tube-like ship. This one was a wheel.
Wow.
And it was massive.
Wow.
It was huge.
What can you give us a dimension, what you think it might be? Like 100 feet, like a football field length, 100 yards?
I'm not sure how big those plazas are. They're probably... my goodness, they must be 2 or 3 football fields. And when it came over the plaza there, I would say that it pretty much covered the plaza.
So it was massive.
It was circular. It was massive.
Wow.
And, then the driver who picks me up, and at first I just, kind of ignored him because I'm still thinking about what I had seen. He asked me, did you see the UFO last night? and he said that, he had seen it, that people had seen it in Guatemala, and they said that it headed toward, in the direction of Copan. And so that was another validation. And then the very next night in Guatemala, the same spacecraft that I described appeared over a hotel where I was staying.
My God, that's fascinating.
So, yeah, but I didn't see it that night. The other people in the hotel, other guests saw it, but I had been up all night the night before and had gone to bed. And even though my phone rang, I just ignored it and stayed in bed, And, of course, I live to regret that because...
Oh, boy.
But when people told me about it, and I'm open to those things because I know they exist.
Of course.
There's no question in my mind.
Wow, that would have been a great opportunity to take your smartphone and take a picture.
Well, I don't have a smartphone.
Okay.
I don't carry smartphones. I just have a little track phone.
Phone. Okay.
Yep, I don't carry things.
You would be quite famous. You could put that on your the cover of your book, Sky People.
it's interesting because I use a computer solely for the purposes of recording my stories and transcribing my stories from tapes and notes, and to do a little shopping and to get emails, and I'm not into all these sophisticated devices and so I'm interested in what I want to be just as to appear to be a part of those communities when I go there,
right.
I don't need all those fancy trappings.
I hear you.
And I don't have them in my life either. I'm not on a Facebook or I don't Twitter or do any of that stuff.
Right. Well, thankfully, you've at least put this information down in a great book. Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. Fantastic. Listen, in the last couple of minutes, Dr. Clark, why don't you tell us what you want people to take away from this book? Why is it important that they pick it up? Just in a couple of minutes, that's all I have left for you. But tell us, what do you think about that? What's your impression? What do you want people to be impressed with?
Well, I think that it is the first time, well, at least to hear the voices of the people, and what they share about their connection with the cosmos. And not mm-hmm. somebody interpreting what their connection was. That mm-hmm. if you read this book, you're going to get a totally different view of the Maya and their connection with the universe, and not someone coming from the outside and making judgments. You will hear the people themselves tell their story. And that mm-hmm. is, I think, what is so unique about what I found and what I write about.
Fantastic. Okay, the book, Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. My guest today has been Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark. And it is available on Amazon. I just checked. And I think if you do a search for her book, I'm going to post it on my Facebook page, links to get the book. It's a fantastic read. I haven't been able to get through it. It has, I think it's got at least 25 or more chapters.
Oh, it's more than that. I think what I have, I think there's over 40 stories. Let's see.
Is it? Oh, let's take a look here. There, yeah, you're right. There's there's a total of 46 chapters. Boy, I'm looking at it right now.
Right.
And they're all stories and interviews of various encounters with off-world beings, and even some connections with ancient parts of the Mayan culture that relate to what we call, unfortunately, ancient astronauts.
And even myth. You know, I try, if there's an ancient story related to the places I visit, I try to give the reader that information as well, you know, because sometimes people say, well, why did you go to that place? It's so remote. Mm-hmm. Well, I went there because I had heard this story, and I wanted to talk to the people about the story. And then other stories unfold and find that maybe a village has had a history of encounters.
Wow. I would like if people
read the book that, you know, I have a webpage, sixkiller.com, and people can also send me emails, and I answer every single email at artie@sixkiller.com. I'd just like to know how you felt about the book once you read it.
Fantastic. So the website, again, is it artie6killer.com?
The website is sixkiller.com.
Okay.
And then my email address is artie@sixkiller.com.
Okay, so they can go there and connect with you and learn more, ask questions.
And, I have other things on there, stories I've written, different things that aren't published anywhere else.
Okay, fantastic. I'll put those on the Facebook page and also on the radio station link page so that people connect. It's been a pleasure speaking with you again, Artie. I hope you have
a
great holiday.
Other things we could talk about.
We could talk for the whole day, I'm sure. We could probably go out and get lunch, come back, and do another 2 or 3 hours.
I know. And because, there's the stories were so varied. The Aleutians, the little people, the giants it's just amazing, some of the stories, the mutilation of animals, mm-hmm. just a variety of different themes that we hear about but it's very different what the stories they tell.
Fantastic. It's a pleasure as always, and much success to you in the future. And are you having, is another book in the plans for you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm currently working on a third.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'll look forward to reading more about your journeys, and again, much success. Until next week, please stay tuned and make sure that you keep an eye on what's going on the Facebook page. It's Earth Ancients at Facebook, and we'll talk to you next time.